So yeah, I'm going a little bit off book, I guess. Actually, we're going really on book.
Going in a different direction.
What?
I'm glad we get you
water.
Water.
Water. 45 minutes, all right. Good. So yeah, you might have noticed that there's a lot of words.
Yeah, I was like, where are the pictures? Where are my pictures?
Where are the bullet points that are only 4 words long?
Yeah. Gosh, I missed those.
Well, what I decided to do was, for my own selfish gain, because I'm considering doing Second John for my thesis.
Oh.
I figured might as well do a preliminary exposition of it and see if I want to spend the next year studying this book.
Why are you thinking of doing that?
Because it's a nice length for a thesis, and I'd like to. I have to write a 20 to, or 40 to 60 page paper expositing some text, and so it can't be too long, but I like thinking through an entire book, thinking through an argument of an entire book as opposed to just a section of it, because I feel like you missed something. So, yeah, the one chapter books are good lengths for doing a thesis exposition. And I like some of the questions that come with Second John. So, essentially what I did was, first I translated the book for you. That sounds impressive, but it's only 13 verses. So.
I was going to say, it's not much of a book.
Yeah. So yeah, you have my translation there, so we're just going to kind of work through. Essentially what I did was I recorded my...
I love your little Stephen's English translation.
Yeah.
There's no such thing.
It's great.
I essentially gave you what I do when I'm studying a book. Yeah, a while ago we talked about how to study your Bible, right? Observation, interpretation, application.
Mm-hmm.
So I just gave you my observation, interpretation, application of Second John. So I figured we'd read the book and then kind of just walk through observations, interpretations, and then finish with the application. This is how I do it when I sit down to study a passage of the Bible. So, I'll read verses 1 through 3 and somebody else can read the rest. Already messed up a word. The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not I only, but also all the ones who know the truth. Through the truth living in us and with us, it will be into eternity. It will be with us grace, mercy, peace, from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love.
I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it. For so many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your elect sister greet you.
Stephen's English translation?
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, so I stick with some of the broken English here and there just because I like the more literal
Go for it.
So, yeah, like, I hope to be near you and to talk mouth to mouth. That's what it actually says. But English translations won't say that because that's not. That's an idiom.
Flowy.
Yeah. So, did my observation interpretation application, and I kind of, when I do it, I combine the observation and the interpretive question. So as I'm observing, I ask questions about the observations I make. So, first of all, let's look at just verses 1 through 3. Some questions should arise in your mind. Examples: who is the elder? Who is the elect lady? Who are the elect lady's children? What does it mean to love in truth? I think the ESV said the exact same thing. I love in truth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an idiom for something? Is that like a phrase that just means, I really love you? Or is there something more significant to that phrase? That's just verse one. In the next section, I guess we can go back and forth. I just copy all those questions down, and then I start thinking through what are the answers. I might go look at a commentary, I might search online, or my primary goal is to find it within the text of the document itself. If the answer is there, then use that answer, because that's the right answer. If it's not, then you gotta do a little bit more work. So, who's the elder? Probably the Apostle John. This letter is traditionally taken as Johannine, and no linguistic or outside sources make a compelling case against such designation. There's pretty much from the beginning, everyone agreed this is something that John wrote. It matches his style, matches his word choice. Nobody ever really questions that the Apostle John wrote this, so that's what we go with. The technical word, though, is the elder is the one writing this. The presbyter is another legitimate translation. As for the elect lady and her children, this one gets a lot of debate about the book of 2 John. What do you guys think? Who's the elect lady and who are her children?
I can look on a sheet and tell you who you think they are.
I want to know what your thoughts are before you read mine. Just as you're sitting there reading the book of 2 John, and you come across that, the elder to the elect lady and her children.
I mean, I'm very literal, so I would just be like, oh, it's clearly a person.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's an option.
But that's me being very literal. And just saying, oh, that's what's there, that's what it must be.
Which I agree, that's the right way to go about it. It's the right way. That's your first instinct, is to always just take the words at their face value.
I always just hated an English class where the teacher's like, but what's deeper?
What's
in
the
metaphor?
Yeah. I hated.
What did the author write into it, what they didn't actually write?
Metamorphosis by Kafka. I hate analyzing that book.
Engineers don't like to. Oh, God. Extra meaning that's not really there. That's like a trick to us. We're like, are you. Yes.
Well, Kafka,
what are you saying in
Kafka
here?
Is a book about a guy turning into a cockroach, right?
Oh, good.
The Metamorphosis is about a guy turning into a cockroach. And there's supposed to be all this great significance, right? No. We find out later, Kafka was actually insane.
And thought
he was
committed.
He thought he was turning into a cockroach. That's the meaning.
Wow.
Strahlen had read about once, but like in class, they were like, why did the author say that the curtains were blue? What does that represent? And she's like, the curtains were blue.
They were
that,
yeah. like
that's
the color
that they were. So
yeah.
That's what Charlotte said.
So decorated
she said
room.
It, or somebody was like, somebody in the classroom was like, that's the color. I think that's just what he decided. The color it's not red. The curtains are blue. Like,
English,
doesn't mean he's depressed.
In
you know,
English,
like,
they train you like look for all these different things, and
yeah.
everything's
right.
there for a specific
English
reason.
Class.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah, can't stand that. So, there's my answer.
So, here's the two common proposed answers, the one you just gave, that it's some certain lady that John is writing a letter to, and he's writing to her and her children.
Yeah.
I think that is a valid approach to take. However, I think that the other option is probably a better one for a few reasons. The other option is that it's a metaphor for the elect lady is the church, the local church in that place, and her children are the individual members of that local church. The reason I would say that seems more likely to me is really twofold. One, verse 5, he switches. He says, "Now I'd ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing to you a new commandment, but one that we have had from the beginning, that we love one another, and this love is that we walk according to his commandments." He switches from the singular second person, you, to more of a corporate third person, more of a corporate first person, or a plural second person. So linguistically, about halfway through the letter, he starts talking like the elect lady is a metaphor, or a figure of speech for something. It also, verse 13, "the children of your elect sister greet you," fits a lot better, I think, if John is talking about another church and their members greet you, because that's a common sign-off in epistle, and in all the epistles Paul will often write. "The saints in Ephesus greet you. The saints of wherever I am say hello, by the way." So John might be continuing the metaphor, saying, you know, the children in this other church, the people who make up this other church in the city I'm in, greet you also. For those two reasons, I tend to think that the elect lady and her children are reference to a local church. But I would say that the other interpretation is valid. I just don't think it's as strong. Regardless, you can still interpret the whole text almost exactly the same way. There's a few things where your interpretation will diverge based on who you think the elect lady is.
But you never actually find out.
Correct. It is shrouded in mystery until the resurrection.
Great.
There'll be a line for people who, when they get resurrected, they'll be like, "Yeah, yeah, good to see you. First, I want to know who wrote Hebrews, and I want to know who the elect lady is. Okay, please."
Before I take one step more, I need to know the answer.
I'm just going to be like, "I'm so glad to be here."
Yeah.
They're not down there.
That's going to be the reality.
Yeah.
What elect lady?
What are you referring to?
All right. And what does it mean to love in truth? Again, so I sat down and I thought through it. No clear linguistic reference is available. However, a systematic approach might lead us to conclude that in truth could be a vague reference to the truth of the gospel and the truth of the bodily resurrection, the second coming of Christ. Compare verse 4, living in the truth. So, what is that? And then the message of the deceivers, verse 7, which we can talk about a little bit in a minute. But you keep working through, and we're not going to go through all of the questions that I raised, because you can do that on your own time if you'd like. Lots of these just don't matter that much. But the things is like, make sure you understand. Make sure that there's a valid interpretation. But verse 4. "I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father." What command? How did I translate that? "Just as we received a commandment from the Father." What commandment are we talking about? Yeah, I think that's probably the best option. "I entreat you, lady, not as if I'm writing to you a new commandment, but that which we heard from the beginning." What?
That
we might love one another. That is the central theme of 2 John. Love one another. If you want to know what 2 John is about, that's what it's about. love one another, primarily. There's a secondary thing, however, which comes up as you keep reading. So, verse 5, command that you love one another, and love is this. He defines love, that we might live according to his commandments. So, how do you love one another? Well, you do what Jesus said to do. That'll come up again in the applications section. But we're not there yet, so keep that in the back of your mind. This is the commandment, just as you heard from the beginning, so that in it you would live or walk. That's the commandment. Love one another. Do it. Reiterating. Why? Okay, so that's where it shifts. Why is this so important that we do this, that we love one another? We follow the commandments of Jesus. Verse 7. Because many deceivers have gone out into the world. They're claiming, and this is a weird thing to translate, they're claiming not that Jesus is coming in flesh. I think that's how I put it. How did the ESV put that? You may have different translations of that.
Verse 7. What verse?
Verse 7.
Verse 7.
What are the deceivers claiming?
Many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist.
I think that's a good rendering. Those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh.
Yeah, mine just says those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh.
Yeah. As coming in the flesh. It's a participle. That's a weird thing to translate. It's hard to get the emphasis across. The question is, what coming in the flesh is John referring to that they're denying, right? So think with me systematically. Jesus came once in the first Advent in the flesh, right? Advent in the flesh. We also believe that he will return, right? Will he return in the flesh? Yeah, because he's in a resurrected body. That's going to happen. So these deceivers, these people who are teaching something false, which one are they denying? Or are they denying both? Are they denying that Jesus ever showed up and had a physical body? Right. Or are they denying the second coming? They're saying Jesus died, he rose again, but he's not coming back. That's a different... So, there's this tension here.
Wasn't the Gnostic influence pervasive, and they were making sure that the people knew that Jesus wasn't just a spirit, he actually came
good
in the flesh.
Yeah, the so
John,
where did
I think First John is when they
First John is often
talk about that.
Viewed as a big polemic against incipient Gnosticism, early Gnosticism. The physical incarnation essential to John's message, the gospel. It was a major point of contention with Gnostics of various kinds in later centuries. Perhaps an early form of Gnosticism is the teaching that John has in mind. So yeah, you bring in the historical context. Right? We see other places where John seems to be writing against Gnostics specifically, particularly in 1 John. So yeah, that is lends credence to the idea that what he's writing against is people who are saying that Jesus' first coming, he didn't have a physical body. He seemed to have one, but he's really just spirit. He's not fully man. So the proper doctrine dispute is, was Jesus fully human? That's the doctrinal dispute that he's writing against. Or, if we're talking about the second coming, the proper doctrinal dispute would be, is Christ returning? Is the gospel message true? Like, essentially, the whole resurrection is in question here. Then he uses a strong word to describe these deceivers. Many deceivers have gone out of the world, do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. It's a little bit misleading to use the definite article there. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. It's probably more of an indefinite meaning. So, such a one is a deceiver, is antichrist, antichrist. Antichrist literally means opposing the anointed one. So, this may be a reference to the larger theological idea of a particular man who will come in the future, as in the Antichrist, Revelation 13. Or it may be to a general spirit movement of opposition to Christ and his church, or to many false teachers who will appear and encourage such a spirit movement, spirit/movement, which would be more in line with his early epistle. Let's see. 1 John 2:18. So we bring in the context of John's other writings, like we just did. 1 John 2:18, he's writing against probably the same thing. Children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard, the Antichrist is coming. So now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. So John uses the word Antichrist in two different ways there, to refer to one particular guy, the Antichrist. And then, to many, well, you might try to... Good night.
Guys, wait!
Did he say Godspeed? He said go to sleep. Oh. Stop
fitting. I like Godspeed.
Right. Yeah. Godspeed, go to sleep. I haven't heard that since the Mayflower.
Where was I?
First John 2:18.
So yeah, might be talking about the Antichrist, some future prophetic man, world leader, Revelation 13 kind of Antichrist. Or it might be using a small a, like someone who is anti-Christ. I would tend to think that the general spirit... The indefinite article is a deceiver, is an antichrist, is an antichrist, is what he means in 2 John. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Again, this is a weird thing to translate, and I don't quite know what he was trying to say. Watch yourself so that you might not lose that which we accomplished, but you might receive back full payment. This was my translation. What is meant by this? I don't know. If you have any thoughts, let me know. Things that I suggested as what did they accomplish? What is the full payment? As for what did they accomplish, I thought maybe community, right? Tight-knit group within the church, perhaps what they accomplished with sound doctrine, which would make sense given that he's just told them to guard yourselves against these people who are not teaching the sound doctrine of who the Christ is. So maybe that. As for the full payment, I don't know. Possibly the resurrection, but that seems odd because John knows the gospel is by grace and not by works, so I don't think he would be referring to that as something that was worked for. But maybe he's drawing a distinction between the things we worked for versus the payment that you received by grace.
Or maybe it's the work of the apostles in how they went out and preached the good news and new believers were saved.
Ooh, that's so good.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, because they went out, they actually did work, and that they did accomplish something. Yeah, and they were working to spread the good news and start new churches.
Yeah, all right.
So they want to protect that, the new believers.
All right, yeah. So that's what they accomplished. I like that. What's the payment, you think?
I guess their reward is to see them come to maturity in Christ, or it could be a reward in heaven, the crowns that they get for being faithful to the Lord.
That's good. I like that. Good thoughts. Moving a little bit further down, we have a textual variant. Yeah, my textual criticism is paying off. Twice he references the teaching and this teaching. Everyone who... Let me read my translation. Everyone, all men, going on and not living by the teaching of Christ. He, or they, don't have God. Any man who's not living by Christ's teaching, you don't have God. The one living in the teaching, or the one living in love. That's the textual variant. Some manuscripts will say the one living in the teaching. Others will say the one living in love. This man has both the Father and the Son. So the question is this the teaching? What is the teaching in view? That is probably the correct reading based on the manuscript evidence. The teaching is probably the original. But a whole lot of scribes decided to scratch out the word teaching and put in love.
I feel like maybe it kept more in line how they felt the message was going.
Yeah. They were trying to help you out. They're saying,
John talks about love.
John,
a lot,
this
right?
Teaching is vague. You're talking about this thing that you referenced before, right? Love one another. That was the commandment at the beginning. So let's just put this in
he
here.
He talks
to
about love
reader.
A lot, right? In his writings.
Yeah.
So maybe they felt like that made more sense.
Yeah, love is a pretty common theme in John's writings. Where are you? So, the question I raised is this teaching the same teaching throughout the letter? If not, where does it change? If so, what is the teaching in question? I think this teaching is the same teaching through the letter, and all uses of it, of the phrase or idea, are references back to the commandment in verses 5 and 6, love one another. This is supported by some manuscripts which replace the word teaching with love. It might also be a reference to the teaching that Christ came in the flesh, in contrast to the teaching of the deceivers. But this opposition is less likely. And then you get to one of the most well-known commands in 2 John, which is, what do you do with the people who are teaching this nonsense that Christ is the coming of Christ isn't in the flesh? Mm-hmm. Everyone who goes on ahead doesn't abide in the teaching, or if the people who are teaching who are not abiding in love. Regardless, what do you do with those people who aren't abiding by the teaching? If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into a house or give him any greeting. And I just realized in the ESV it actually says your house. And I translated it a house, and I thought that I was correct in that, but let me make sure. Talk amongst yourselves while I find this.
I was going to say, NASB says your house.
So does NIV.
Okay. I probably just read it wrong then. So, all of the stuff that I wrote about a house makes no... is completely wrong.
Yeah, even NLT says your home.
Let me make sure.
Receive someone
where it
into
says
a house.
A house is yeah. left indefinite and non-possessive.
Yeah.
That section.
Yeah,
that
scratch
section. That out.
I could have sworn it didn't. It wasn't possessive. What verse is that? Verse 10. Oikion. Oikion. Graphe. I'm pretty sure that I'm right and everyone else is wrong. But that doesn't make sense. I'm usually wrong. Let me get this to parse for me. Do not receive him, ace, into oikion, a house. Kai Kain Auto. And the joy of him. He does not say the joy of him. Yeah, no, I'm right. It is indefinite and not possessive.
What would your house be?
What else did I put there?
On the back page.
Yeah. It is interesting that a house is left indefinite and non-possessive, and I'm correct. It is left indefinite and non-possessive in the Greek text. Perhaps,
so when they translate it, they change it to your?
Yeah, most everybody are just reading that and they're saying...
This makes the most sense.
This makes the most sense.
Like that.
Well,
because it's
italics,
awkward.
Italics, and it says italics are used to indicate words which are not found in the original Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, but implied by it.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's
yours,
why you said it.
Is yours italics?
Mine's in italics, too.
Yeah. That's what the NASB does when they're indicating something that's not necessarily in the text, but it makes sense. It makes it read smoother.
Yeah.
So, because it's awkward to say, do not invite them into a house.
Do not give him. But it says,
go into that house over there.
Yeah.
You're invited to that house. Over there.
I promise.
But, so, my point is valid. It's interesting that a house is left indefinite and non-possessive. It's not your house, it's a house. Perhaps this reflects John's assumption that the letter would be circulated as the later epistle of Revelation was obviously intended to be. Perhaps it is an instruction to individual believers not to be hospitable to false teachers because helping them would be helping their message. These ideas are conjecture, of course. So possibly it helps us to understand the purpose behind the letter better. That was why I brought it up. I don't know if you were here, Bethany, but I vindicated myself.
Oh, yeah? What'd you do? How'd you do that?
I just triple-checked that it is a house and not your house.
So the Bible translations are wrong?
Yes. It doesn't matter too much.
It's like you need to pat you on the head or something.
That change makes almost no difference in terms of the meaning, but I found it interesting.
Aha! Uh-huh. Just because I have to know for sure.
Yeah.
I'd pat you on the head if you want.
And there's one more odd phrase in here, which is at the end. So the ESV translate this way, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting. The most literal translation is do not say to rejoice in him. Like, do not speak of rejoicing in him, essentially. Also, to rejoice, that infinitive is often used as like it's like a hello. So do not say a greeting to him. It would be exactly what he says. What does it mean? It means don't throw your support behind and promote his teachings. Or more simply, don't welcome him. This is an idiom most English translations merely render do not welcome him. To rejoice was a common phrase, similar to an Aggie's howdy, or a normal person's hello.
Normal person. Plebeian's version.
Yeah. Us Aggies are not normal. And then the last little bit of the elect sister. Application, though. I drew out of this text 3 points of application. And I'm just going to read them, because I think I worded it all right. First, John clearly wants the reader to guard their doctrine, and in particular the doctrine of the physical incarnation. It would be wise for all readers of this letter to do likewise. We may have different assaults on our doctrine than were common in the first century, but assaults will come. We must study to show ourselves approved and recognize the power of Scripture for teaching, reproof, correcting, and training in righteousness. That was your 1 Timothy 3:16 reference there. John clearly wants the readers to love one another. This is the primary exhortation he gives to the elect lady and her children. Loving one another is central to the Christian life. What does it mean to love one another? How does this play out in our lives? There's some questions for you to answer in your personal application. John repeatedly exhorts the reader to live or walk according to Jesus' commandments. Again, we not only have to know what Jesus' commandments were, but do them as well.
An easy and straightforward application of this text might be to sit down and list all the clear commandments of Jesus, exposit them in context, and begin doing them in our lives. Such actions as feeding the hungry, clothing the poor, teaching the truth, preaching the gospel, doing what is right instead of what is evil are good starting places. So that's observation, interpretation, application of 2 John. Other thoughts, observations you guys made? Things we can talk about from this text? Whatever you hit on? Anything jump out at you while you were reading? Like, that's weird. Well, we didn't talk about it.
Truth and love are repeated quite a few times.
Mm.
I think truth is like 5.
Yeah. What do you think? What point do you think he's making about the truth and or the love?
That you need the truth in order to love. They're going hand in hand in almost every sentence.
Yeah. I agree. You can't really have one without the other.
Yeah. You can't love people if you don't have the truth of the gospel. I guess you can try because you're made in the image of God, so in some way you can love people.
But it'll be
selfish, probably.
It'll be empty.
Self-serving.
And likewise, you can't have the truth if you don't love people. If your idea of the truth doesn't involve love of other human beings and love of God, you don't have the truth.
On verse 10, and on here you said the teaching in question, were you saying that you think it's the love one another, or were you saying, you're saying that the second one is less likely?
Yeah, I think that the teaching in question, anyone who comes to you and doesn't carry this teaching, would be somebody who comes to you and isn't displaying Christian love.
Okay, but in it you were just talking about Christ coming in the flesh.
Yeah.
So why would you not think it would be more of that one?
Because of the textual variance. And I think there's strong support for both.
For both.
Very slight edge to the idea that the teaching in question is to love one another. One, because of the textual variance, the fact that so many manuscripts actually have the word love there instead of this teaching. And then two, because it refers back to the initial kind of source of the letter. You can definitely find that in the context of the letter. The only question is it in the immediate context or the less immediate context? It's
okay.
Obviously in the less immediate context is the love. The more immediate context would be the teaching of Christ coming in the flesh.
Got it.
But I think the ultimate application of that is the same.
Because, I mean, that one just seems to make more sense to me with verse 10 as well. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, it would seem to make more sense to be someone who doesn't believe that Christ came into the flesh is someone who you would not
invite into your house.
Exactly, rather than someone who doesn't follow the commandment of love.
I think, yeah.
That just seems to make more sense to me, because I feel like you wouldn't be, in like a like literal aspect, you wouldn't be like, oh, you don't love people, I'm not going to love you. It would be more of, oh, you don't believe that Christ, the flesh of Christ or whatever. I feel like that would be a more reason to not want someone
in your house.
Home.
And I agree. I think that's valid.
Okay.
Right.
And we have 5 minutes left.
Do you think that the terms elect lady and bride of Christ have anything to do with one another? Do they relate at all?
I do not think that they do.
Okay.
But a whole lot of Christians who I respect do think that they do. So.
Okay. Because I couldn't help thinking of that when I kept reading elect lady.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, why is it a lady? And but you can't say son because Jesus is a son, so you got confusing sons. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's one of the more common things that's brought up in favor of the elect lady is a local church thing, mm-hmm. the whole Bride of Christ thing. I don't think the church is the Bride of Christ, so...
Oh, okay. What do you think the Bride of Christ is?
I think the Bride of Christ is Israel. But
gotcha.
That's not a popular viewpoint.
It's a very, yeah, it's a very...
Fringe.
Very minority view.
So with your way of thinking, obviously, they're not the same thing.
Yes.
But for a lot of other people, they'll be like, oh, yeah, they're synonymous.
Yeah. And I don't quibble about it too much.
Okay.
That's more for the seminary classroom to...
What's it gonna do, right?
Yeah.
Argue
about it. Okay. But yeah, the whole marriage supper to the Lamb, the thing where we actually see Christ marrying his bride is in chapter 18 of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be Israel in that context. So I go with, well, it's Israel then.
Okay.
That's another lesson for another time, though, because we only have 4 minutes left.
I still have. All right.
Pot. I'm into that.